investigation file complaint 24-15-C, Dr. Jeffrey Coppola. Doctor is present. There is no counsel. We have no complainant on the phone. Dr. Powell is our investigator, and we will hear his report summary.
Okay. I reviewed the complaint 24-15-FC by Mr. BF. His complaint was Dr. Coppola failed to recognize the post op with an infection, which led to 6 days of hospitalization and IV antibiotics. He also complained that he spent thousands of dollars on antibiotics and medical supplies. I'm going to jump down to page 5 of my report. Those other pages summarize the factors. Coppola's care, which I felt was fine. After review of the medical records received, it is my opinion Dr. Coppola's treatment and care of BS was appropriate as well as within the standards of care until his August 19th visit. After review of the August 19, 2024 medical records, the following was of concern. And just to back up, surgery was performed in March. He initially saw the patient on September 25th, 2023, treated him conservatively until time of surgery, which is March 15, 2024. After review of the 819 medical records, the following is of concern. BS's chief complaint on this visit was ongoing pain at the fifth metatarsal phalangeal joint of the left foot. BS stated that there is pain upon wayfaring and ambulation. Dr. Coppola diagnosed BS with a seroma. He reported that the color showed subcutaneous changes in appearance, which was cystic and painful. Dr. Coppola also reported the cyst was deep and affecting BS's sensory and or motor sensation. Dr. Coppola did consent BS for an arthrocentesis joint slash bursa procedure with an incision and drainage procedure, which was performed in his office under local anesthetic. That consent form on that date said incision and drainage of abscess left foot. During that procedure on that day, he aspirated 0.5 mL of serosanguinous joint fluid from the joint and then injected 5 cc's of combination of 1% lidocaine or xylocaine and 40 milligrams of Kenalog, which is steroid. He next performed the incision drainage through a separate 1 centimeter incision and removed 1 cc of serous drainage at that time. The appropriate care and treatment at this time should have been based on the BS's chief complaint of pain at the surgical site and due to the length of time since the initial surgery, which is approximately 6 months, should have been to send the aspirate for the analysis for possible bacterial infection. Dr. Coppola should also have sent a drainage from the incision and drainage site for cultures. Dr. Coppola also should have at least taken radiographs, since the last radiograph was taken was March 21st, which was the first post-op visit approximately 6 months since the last X-ray. And finally, he never should have injected a steroid into a site that could have possibly been infected. The reason not to inject Kenalog into a possible infected site would be that one has a risk of worsening the infection, or this can suppress the immune system to fight off the infection. Suppressing the immune system allows the possible infection to worsen and or allow it to spread. I did talk to the complainant on the phone. Ellen. Mm-hmm. Again, the appropriate approach would have been to analyze the aspirate first, and then if the aspirate was negative, consider the injection of the steroid etenolol. It was evident that Dr. Kokoroff was concerned about the area possibly being infected. He did prescribe an antibiotic and a stone. Dr. Kokoroff next saw BS on 8/26/24. His chart notes show that there was still active serous drainage after the incision and drainage procedure. Dr. Kokoroff did recommend a diagnostic MRI be performed to assess the soft tissue mass. The MRI was performed at 8/19. The MRI was read by Dr. Terry Hiscock, and it did show there was a possible stress reaction with possible osteomyelitis, which could not be ruled out. Based on these MRI findings, Dr. Coppola should have immediately contacted BS. Dr. Coppola should have discussed the MRI findings and recommended appropriate diagnostic tests, such as a bone biopsy, blood test, bone scan, a pain culture from the drainage, and or a CT scan, which would have definitely ruled out and ruled in osteomyelitis, a septic joint, or deep space abscess. He also had he should have at minimum changed the prescription for BS to an appropriate oral antibiotic, one that could treat the possible bone infection, septic joint, and or deep space abscess. The patient never returned to Dr. Coppola's office after this visit of 8/26. However, he did go to the emergency room at Brazos West Campus on 9/7/24. He was diagnosed after another MRI was performed with cellulitis, ulceration, phlegm, and abscess above the fifth distal metatarsal shaft, metatarsal joint, and proximal phalanx. Findings concerning of osteomyelitis of fifth metatarsal head and neck, proximal septic metatarsal phalangeal joint. And this MRI was read by Dr. Natalia Archibi. BS was then admitted to the hospital for 6 days, placed on IV antibiotics, and had a deep incision and drainage surgery performed by Dr. Kevin Cole. I did talk to BS on the phone on August 7th. He reported the surgical site did eventually heal after the initial surgery performed on March 15, 2024. He did state that he was concerned about the amount of time it took to heal, as well as the looks of his foot. He has stated that this is why he kept returning to Dr. Kokoroff's office. Once the site healed, BS stated his foot continued to be painful, warm, red, and swollen. BS also stated that he never had a follow-up to older discharge from the surgical site, and he described the drainage as clear, red, and yellow, and yellow at times. BS stated that the foot remained reddened all the time. BS described pain as low-grade type of pain, which was constant and painful for nothing. He also said he had very little motion at the site. Dr. Kokoroff's report in his chart notes that BS never took the penicillin after the osteosynthesis and the incision and drainage he performed on 8/19/24. BS stated he did take the penicillin, which was upsetting his stomach, which he told Dr. Kokoroff. Dr. Kokoroff instructed BS to stop taking the penicillin and did not prescribe a different antibiotic. The last visit BS was on 8/26/24. Dr. Coppola's reported that BS never returned for a follow-up appointment. On questioning BS, he reported that the weekend prior to his appointment with Dr. Coppola, at the advice of his son-in-law, who is a registered nurse, he's a military nurse in Germany, told him to go to the hospital. BS stated that he was experiencing increased pain, redness, and limited motion of the site, and he was experiencing excessive amounts of bowel odor drainage. That's when his son told him to go to the hospital. BS did go to the emergency room at Bravo Hospital, and the emergency room another MRI was taken. I'll skip that. BS was placed on IV, cefepime, and daptomycin. BS was sent home after 6 days in the hospital with a PICC line. BS continued IV Dr. Green is apprehended for 6 weeks at home following his discharge from a Bravo hospital. DS also had home health care nurses change the foot dressings 3 times a week. DS did report in our conversation that he is now healed and has minimal pain. He did state that he does have swelling at times, but does not seem to hinder him. I did try to talk to Dr. Coppola. On November 8th, I did call his office and left the message, and the message that was supposed to be left so that they would get the message to me, would immediately call me back. I didn't get a call back. I followed up with 2 separate emails, one on November 13th and one on November 25th. I wrote this investigation report on 12/18. I did end up getting a call from Dr. Coppola on December 22nd. So my conclusion after review of the records, I did review the patient ledgers, which were enclosed for review. All the insurance payments and adjustments were appropriately recorded. No unusual findings were seen. I did review the radiographs. The radiographs taken preoperatively and postoperatively did confirm that BS did have a payment plan, and the ostectomy of the fifth metatarsal was performed at Dr. Coppola was performed appropriately. I did review the photographs provided. There were a total of 19 photographs, including the medical records. Although most of the pictures did not have a patient's name or initials, only dates on them, they do appear to be BS's left foot, and the dates in the pictures do correspond with BS's scheduled office visit. It is my opinion the concerns I found on the was the August 19, 2024 visit and forward from that date. The fact that Dr. Coppola on that day served injected cortisone without an appropriate workup of BS did fall below the standard of care. In view of the length of time since the date of surgery, March 15th, greater than 6 months, and that the area was still red and swollen and painful, at minimum radiograph should have been taken prior to the injection. Dr. Coppola did diagnose BS with a seroma at this visit. Typically, a seroma occurs 24 to 48 hours from the date of surgery, not greater than 6 months. Proper diagnosis of post-operative seroma should have been performed with an ultrasound, an MRI, or CT scan. Dr. Coppola should also have ruled out any ongoing infective process prior to the steroid injections. The literature clearly states that cortisone is contraindicated in a possible infected area. The cortisone can mask the pain and cause the spreading of the infection by suppressing the immune system. The standard of care was not followed and should have been followed at least in part. Radiograph. Last radiograph was taken 3/21/24, which was BS's first postoperative visit. Dr. Coppola should have sent the aspirates from the joint and the incision and drainage fluid for identification prior to the injection of cortisone. Once the testing showed no infectious process, then an injection would have been appropriate. Again, Dr. Coppola should have sent the aspirates. In addition, once the MRI was ordered to perform on 8/27/24 at Simon Med, this was after the office procedure had been performed and findings suggesting that there was marrow edema and osteomyelitis could not be ruled out, appropriate antibiotics or even a referral to an infectious disease specialist should have been ordered, as well as further appropriate diagnostic testing. Dr. Coppola followed the standard of care for PET. BS would not have been hospitalized and had an additional 36 weeks surviving antibiotics. In addition, BS may not have spent thousands of dollars. So the key findings in this is the treatment decisions and surgical documentation are in alignment with current clinical guidelines and best practices of the August 19th visit. The decision to give BS cortisone and perform the incision and drainage on this visit without the appropriate workup meets standard of care. Proper patient workup and protocol is not followed. In general, if an infection is present or suspect cortisone injections could be avoided until the infection is ruled out, controlled, and resolved. Follow-up post-MRI also was a breach of standard of care. The MRI did report that osteomyelitis cannot be ruled out. Therefore, Dr. Kopoloff at this point had a duty of care. Dr. Kopoloff has a duty to promptly diagnose the possible bone infection or infectious process by ordering the appropriate tests. Dr. Kopoloff can have made timely efforts to prescribe the appropriate antibiotics for a possible bone infection and or referral to an infectious disease specialist. After review of the medical records and interview with a patient DS, it is concluded that the allegation is substantiated. These breaches are not unfortunate outcomes of medical complications. They are simply deviations from the set standard. I'll end it there.
Thank you. Dr. Talos, is there a separate CPT code for an ID of a seroma, or do they have to use the CPT for ID abscess?
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I would think an ID.
I think it's the same code.
Part is the same code, Dr. Formula. Okay, that's what, you know, I did, because I don't have an updated CPT book, so I couldn't look.
Okay. Yeah, 101, 60, or 61, depending on how severe.
Okay, thanks. Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for Dr. Talos?
No, it was a very complete report. Thank you.
Ms. Johnson Gray, do you have any questions for Dr. Talos?
I do not.
Thank you. Ms. Roman, any questions for Dr. Talos?
No, thank you. Very good.
Thank you. All right. So, let's go ahead and Dr. Kopoloff, if you want to come and have a seat and discuss the findings of the investigator's report and your viewpoint.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Talos. Thank you, Board. I have a first comment after Dr. Talos has rendered. I think I started off by saying the patient came to me on 8/19. For an ongoing problem. I would take objection to that only because this was not an ongoing problem. This was a separate problem. As Dr. Talos said, I first saw the patient in September of 23 and rendered conservative care for a problem. And then by March of 24, we engaged in surgery. As Dr. Talos alluded to, we saw the patient honestly many times postoperatively. We have photo documentation of every visit. So I do not, it's a small point, but I wouldn't say it was ongoing. I mean, maybe ongoing in the sense that the patient has had problems with his left foot, but the 8/19 visit, in my opinion, was in a sense, a new problem. So I'll just focus on the 8/19 visit if that's okay. I did diagnose the patient on 8/19. With a seroma, it could have been a soft tissue mass diagnosis. I did aspirate some fluid, but the fluid was clear in color. It wasn't pustular. I did not send the content, quite frankly, there wasn't very much content, and I did not send it out for review simply because it didn't appear clinically substantial. If the foot on 8/19, and I'm looking at the photographs right now, if the foot appeared like it was infected, it was red,
swollen, painful. If it had ascending cellulitic streaking, I would have sent the patient to the same hospital that he presented to, because my office is 100 yards from the hospital. I practiced on the campus, but it did not look that way. On 8/19, the patient, I believe 8/19, or maybe it was 8/26, let me just check. The patient asked to go golfing. Now, I bring that up because the patient is a 35-year-old gentleman who is under cardiovascular care and is exceptional in his cardiovascular fitness. He goes on the treadmill every second day, plays golf, so it's treadmill golf, treadmill golf. And I believe that part of his vigorous cardiovascular fitness may have contributed to what Dr. Callis was referring to, maybe an ongoing left foot problem, generally speaking. So I say he went golfing because he was obviously able to go golfing that day. So the clinical picture, which was presented to me, is very slightly different than how Dr. Callis presented it. Point being is, if the foot was red and swollen and pustular and draining, I certainly would have sent him to the hospital. That was not the case. So 8/19, we do send him home on antibiotic, and he went asked, and it's all in the record. I'm not, I'm just going by what the record said. The patient did not take his antibiotic. The patient related that he did not take any antibiotic as prescribed, and he stated that he's doing well and following instructions, except not taking the antibiotic. We have photographs of the foot on 8/26. I hope the board members have looked at the photographs, because that's the best way to convey what I was seeing through the photography. So I write in my chart, and by the way, when we talk about a seroma, I'm not questioning what Dr. Callis said about seroma, and there's a certain a time frame, but a seroma can take up to a year to fully resorb, and they also may calcify, and I'm thinking that the vigorous golf activity and pivoting off the foot may have contributed to this so-called ongoing problem. On the 8/26 visit, if you look at the additional findings, I did say there's evidence of active serous discharge noted from a 1 millimeter opening at the lateral aspect of the fifth metatarsal phalangeal joint. And I say there is no evidence of pustular discharge nor cellulitis noted on the left foot. Further down on the same page on this reading, number 2, I advise patient that because there is active serous discharge noted after incision and drainage procedure, I have advised that the patient would be an appropriate candidate for MRI study to better assess the state of the soft tissue mass left foot. I advise the patient that the soft tissue mass may be a seroma, ganglion cyst, inflamed burst, occlusion cyst, even giant cell tumor. So as Dr. Callis related, I did order an MRI. So I write here, I advise that the patient, that's on 826, if the drainage is not resolved, and based upon MRI findings, which he had the very next day, he was awesome. The patient was really awesome because he got an MRI the very next day, which is great because it's not always easy. So based on the MRI findings, this is what I advised him, he would most likely be an appropriate candidate for outpatient soft tissue mass excision of the left foot under general anesthesia at ambulatory surgical center. The patient did relate on a side note on 8/26. This is 8/26, not 19. 8/26, that he's going to go golf today. I told him that would be okay. Just pad the foot and bandage the foot accordingly as needed. So on 8/26, we saw him. On 8/27, I do order an MRI. Dr. Talis is correct. The radiologist did make a thorough report. In the report it says, however, associated osteomyelitis cannot entirely be excluded. That is absolutely true. Most post-op foot surgeries within a time frame, I don't know what that time frame is, when read by a radiologist, the findings are very similar to those of osteomyelitis, and every radiology report that I've ever read always says, however, osteomyelitis cannot be entirely excluded. That's not to diminish that it could have been, but so the last time I see the patient after seeing him all these visits is on 8/26, and as Dr. Talis's report says, he then reports to the hospital on 9/7. I was never told about it. The hospital never reached out. Sometimes they do, I guess. Sometimes they don't. I don't know why they didn't, but they didn't reach out to me. So I never saw the patient again to take care of him. I don't know if this is irony. I don't want to say it's irony, but if you follow my train of thought in treating the patient, I told the patient on 8/26, most likely you're going to need more surgery. The surgery is going to entail making an incision at the area and obviously biopsying soft tissue and perhaps bone as well. But it would have been done on 8/26. My approach would have been as an outpatient, but as Dr. Talis said, he took advice from a family member who said, just go to the hospital on 9/7. So 8/26 and 9/7, that's like 11 or so days. Anything in those days could have transpired. I don't have any photographs of the patient's foot on 9/7 or 9/6. The last time I saw him was on the 26th of August. And again, I ordered the MRI. I know Dr. Talis said, well, you know, you should have done an x-ray on the visit when he came in. He could have had an x-ray. But again, my surgery was an osteectomy, so I wasn't concerned about any form. The patient had no screw, no plate, no hardware. The patient looked overall very, very good. And again, that's why I asked the board to look at the photographs. That's the closest that you would see what I was seeing. I was very much aware of the patient's state in his foot, so much that I did order study, a imaging study, but it wasn't an X-ray, it was an MRI, which he would have another one when he went to the hospital. Yeah, so I think I've covered the points that I wanted to after Dr. Talis's very thorough report and investigation. Obviously, as a physician, and I say this specifically to our public members, Ms. Johnson Gray and Ms. Roman, I didn't abandon my patient, and I don't believe I performed substandard care. I took care of this patient since September of 2023, and then he presented with what would be a new problem on August 19 of 2024. If we focus on the August 19 and August 26 visits, those are only two visits. So I would say to the public members that the patient didn't afford me the opportunity to continue care. So that wasn't my decision, that was his decision. And the patient, by the way, the patient was informed when we ordered the MRI that he should follow up after the MRI. So you have to understand, I have this relationship with this patient since September of 23. The patient came to my office many, many, many times. It was his decision to get the MRI very quickly, which is awesome. But it was also his decision not to return to the treating doctor and let that foot maybe fester or continue his cardiovascular exercises or his golfing for 11 more days before a family member tells him, you know, go to the ER. Which I'm not questioning. The only thing is he didn't come back and see me. And at no time was his foot in such a state that I would have sent him to the hospital. So I can't tell you what transpired between August 26th and September 7th. That's out of what I can tell you, because he didn't come back. And again, for the public members, it wasn't like it was a new patient that never knew me, or I didn't know them, or we didn't establish a relationship on August 19th. He knew the door was always open. We saw him many times. We gave him post-op care. We photographed everything. And I can't comment as to why he didn't come back. He just didn't come back. That was absolutely his decision. It wasn't like he didn't know. Oh, no one called me to come back. We told you, you'd come back right after the MRI. So whatever the day of the week, August 27 is, maybe that's a Friday, I'm not really sure, he could have come in the very next day because he had been doing so. So there was no confusion at all how to come back and see me, or where to see me. We would always see him. He just didn't come back. So I think that's all the comments that I had. Maybe one more comment. Dr. Talis talked about a corticosteroid injection. Why did you make a corticosteroid injection? Because I was concerned about the soft tissue mass, and the corticosteroid injection may have shrunk that seromatous or synovial fluid. in my over 30 years of practice, I've never had the opportunity, I've never in person seen a detriment from a corticosteroid injection. I appreciate what Dr. Callis has reported, and it's true. You know, you can look it up, and it would probably substantiate what Dr. Callis said in the textbook. But in my clinical years of practice, I don't see any reason why that corticosteroid injection, you know, would have caused a detrimental event in the patient. Pulmonologists, and I'm not trying to get fancy, often at the same time prescribe prednisone and antibiotics. I mean, I'm not trying to compare that to this, but so, yeah, I mean, that's just the point, and if we wanted to go head-to-head with that point, I would just ask, if you could, like, show me a study that shows that could happen, and I suppose anything could happen, but I don't think that is the case here, because everyone here can see the photograph a week after the corticosteroid injection. So you have photographs on 8/19 and you have photographs on 8/26. And the foot was, I guess, in such a state on 8/26, the day before the MRI, good enough for the patient to go golfing. I'm not criticizing anyone golfing. I'm just saying the foot was obviously good enough for the man to go golfing. So, so I don't know about the corticosteroid. Thank you.
So, when you examined that day, was there crepitus in that tissue at all?
No.
No. Okay. And was that the area where you took out the soft tissue mass that came back as five unremarkable tumeal fibrous adipose tissue? When you did, so it was in that area that the seroma formed? Was in that incision area?
I would
that
say, I would say that the seroma was more on the dorsal lateral aspect of the fifth toe, and the soft tissue mass was just a little more plantar, lateral plantar, but I think the seroma was lateral, dorsal lateral, and the soft tissue mass was plantar lateral.
So when the patient came to you in 23, he said he'd been having pain for a long time in that foot, and he was an avid runner. Okay, so I'm looking, I don't know if you've got your x-rays with you, but my fellow board members, the x-rays, what page was that on? I had it up here on my computer, and then the computer started to go away. Look at the fifth metatarsal on the medial aspect mid-shaft. Oh, page 819 to my board members. And I'm going to have to enlarge it. But I look at that, and it looks like there's a very strong possibility that patient at one time had suffered a stress fracture of that fifth metatarsal. Didn't change the shape, didn't cause any bowing or any of that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, maybe he would have been better served conservatively initially with an orthotic. Because you do indicate all his biomechanical issues. So maybe he would have been, you know, because of the guy being active, and he sounded like the kind of person who wasn't going to, if he stopped wearing his cam boot at 10 days post-op, he didn't take his prescription that you gave him, I think there's a little bit of maybe patient compliance, and I'm just going to do what I'm going to do. And so,
that you know, just the basic biomechanics of his foot would have been maybe better served, and maybe he would have done very well with an orthotic control that foot, because he's thinking of golf and the positions that, you know, all the irritation that's going to occur with the motions of it going through a swing and all that stuff, that that continued irritation. So I look at that, and then I'm thinking, okay, so everything's going great, and then he shows up, and there's that 5 to 6 month time frame between the surgery, and now we've got this pain again, and yes, you know, the swelling in the tissue, but I'm thinking, I would have taken an x-ray, because I would have been concerned, maybe there's a new stress fracture. You know, that was my thought, that maybe there was something else, that's what I personally would have taken, and with that time difference. And obviously, I did not see your patient clinically. We have the pictures and everything, but personally, I would have sent the stuff to the lab to see what was going on. Even though there wasn't any, you know, pustular, you know, drainage, that time period in between the guy's pre-diabetic and just the way my thought was like, I want to make sure there isn't something else going on. But, and I do agree the way a radiologist reads a report was, they always, to cover their backside, they always say you can't rule that off. That's just part of how a report is read, most, you know.
And that's why I ordered the MRI, the concerns that you mentioned. With regards to orthotics, I don't know what's in my chart right now. I'm sorry, I can't pick that. But maybe I mentioned orthotics to him. Maybe I didn't mention orthotics to him. Most likely, I probably did. Here's the thing about orthotics in my practice. I don't make them. I don't profit from orthotics. I send my patients to an orthotist to have their orthotics made. I'm making an assumption here, and I don't mean any disrespect to the patient, but I would say there's a very high likelihood with this particular patient and his personality and his concern for dollars. I don't know if he paid dollars or Medicare paid or he's concerned about what insurance paid, but orthotics for Medicare recipients, as you know, are not covered.
Right.
And I could almost assure you that even at the market, very low cost that my orthotist charges my patients, $300, he probably would not have purchased them. We have to understand, just for the public members, we can suggest orthotics to patients, and that's all nice until they see, well, it could be $500, $300, and a lot of them at that point don't want that. There's psychology involved too, because, and I don't mean to go off on a tangent, but when a patient comes to us, we are foot surgeons. We are charged with operating on the foot, and they're referred to us by their PCP. A lot of times they're referred to us for that reason, for foot surgery. Sometimes the psychology of patients is they feel if you're not providing them sometimes, or I'll say it in a different way, an orthotic could have been regarded by this gentleman as lesser treatment. I would say, for the public record, I didn't rush to surgery. I saw the gentleman in September of 23. He didn't have surgery till March, so that's, at least six months. I didn't rush to go to surgery, but that's how this case progressed. The patient is looking at you for answers, and Dr. Campbell is absolutely right. In my own opinion, if I can step back outside my body and pretend that I'm not, you know, representing myself, but if I could tell anything to this gentleman, going back, it would be sometimes there's a price to pay, given your age, given your metabolic state, that cardiovascular fitness has a musculoskeletal price to pay. And I know we're in an age where we have to be very gentle and inclusive of all decades of patients, but sometimes we have to tell the 75-year-old patient that's going to play pickleball, I'm not discouraging you from going to play pickleball, but remember, it's not the 25-year-old version of yourself playing pickleball. And if I could go back and tell this gentleman, I would love to tell him that maybe some of the activities he's doing are very harsh on his particular foot. Maybe he did sustain a stress fracture previously. It's very possible. I would that if I could talk to him back in September of 23, that's what I would tell him. However, telling a patient to change your activity and maybe get orthotics is not always received very well by the public, because patients come to you for action. What I've learned in 30 years, you can offer a patient so many options for, let's say, heel pain, and they can leave the office not doing anything. No injection, no orthotics, no PT. They don't want to. And they're the same patient who will say, he was a nice doctor. He gave me a lot of options, but he did nothing. So there's always that balance, that practice management. We want to take care of the patients. We don't want to be overly aggressive, but we also don't want to be under aggressive. So it's very challenging to always satisfy the needs and perceptions of the patient. And I'd like to think with this gentleman, I did a good job. Even when he came back in August, we treated him. I just wish he would have come back after the MRI. And again, and I don't think it's irony, I don't know the word, he ended up having surgery in a setting that, yes, was very expensive in a hospital, where if he came back to me, we probably would have done a very similar procedure, but as an outpatient. That's kind of the irony that I see from this case, because we did talk to him about that on the last visit, and you're probably going to need another procedure. But he didn't afford me the opportunity to continue treating him at that point. And
you had asked, the low dye strapping that you had put on him had worked really well. But your biomechanical exam noted pes planus, forefoot valgus, rift with ferrus tibial verum, and subtalar joint pronation.
And
I know some, you think about the over-the-counter versions of some of the, some of the, prefab orthotics and stuff. But I understand, patients are all, different. It's like, oh, I'm not going to...
He had that genuvalvum, too.
Yeah, so you've got the...
Bowed.
Yeah.
So, of course, the fifth column, the fifth ray, when he's going to bear a lot of weight, and I understand that, and I'm sure when he's golfing, he's pivoting on the foot. When you golf, you're right on that lateral column. But those are things that he enjoys doing, and he does them.
From what I see, like I said, I expressed my opinion that I would have done an X-ray and I would have sent the drainage and waited. But that's how I would have done it. That doesn't mean one way is better, because I really think with watching, what you did, the pictures that you were taking, that the clinical picture is what directed your care of your patients, which is what we do. So that's my remark. Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions or things for Dr. Coppola?
Mm-hmm.
No, but the one thing about steroids is giving it a steroid shot as an antibiotic is against medical literature. The steroid does inhibit the body to fight infection, so that's the only thing I would say. I understand that they give steroids if you're having an upper respiratory infection with antibiotics. It's a little different, in soft tissue, but that's still a common I have.
Ms. Johnson Gray?
Correct, but I would have to have a high suspicion of infection. I agree with you, Dr. Foreman. I'm trying to be objective and fair and look at it from all perspectives. My office where I treat the patient is 100 yards from our hospital. I'm a Brazo employee. When I have patients that come to me and they're cellulitic and they look terrible, I am very, 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 very conservative. I would state that as a matter of fact. If they're cellulitic, I tell them to go to the hospital, which is 100 yards from my office. We also have, at our office, wound care, which is in the same office. So if I have a patient with a bad wound, if I have a patient with a bad infection, I'm going to send them to the hospital. On this particular visit, the only thing that I can submit to you as a fellow surgeon and physician is the foot did not appear clinically at that point where I was ready to send him to the hospital. Even though he ended up 11, 12 days later going to the hospital. Maybe if he came back on, 9-1 or maybe it would have looked different and I would have sent him, but I don't know, and I'll never know what transpired between the 8-26 visit and the 9-7 visit. I'm debating if I should say this, but on behalf of all of our patients and all of our surgeons, when they leave our practice and they leave our care, I mean, anything can happen. Patients develop infections every day for reasons most of us physicians don't even know how a patient develops an infection. Was the infection that he presented with on 9-7, a direct correlation to 8-26 visit? Well, there'd be some correlation, but I don't know to what degree. I don't know that. Maybe investigator knows. I don't know what transpired between that last visit. And of course, again, if I could speak to the patient and say, sir, I wish you would have come back to my office. You always came. You came to me quite a lot. You must have had confidence in me. I mean, if you look at the chart, you must have. I was always there for you. I'm going to go out on a limb, and I don't care if this sounds a terrible thing, and I don't mean to use it, but my wife in May of 24 underwent breast cancer surgery at the Mayo. She had post-op care at the Mayo. The surgeon of record who I met never, ever, ever saw my wife again. So I think we, as podiatrists, and I know I'm off here, we do a good job of our stuff. I work in a multi-specialty group. I work with orthopedic surgeons. I work with neurologists. We we do a good job, I would say, in general as a specialty. And I'd like to say I think I did a good job treating this gentleman. When I think of all the post-op visits that he had, and I'd gladly see him again, but unfortunately he didn't come back. Maybe, you know, the foot got worse, but he didn't come back to allow me to see his foot. And if he did come back, actually, let's just say he came back right after the MRI and the foot looked worse, then either I would take him to surgery, but if the foot was really, really, really bad, I would have probably sent him to the hospital, so he wouldn't have gone on 9/7. He may have gone on 9/1, like it may. So, again, I guess I'm trying to state positive things about. I'm trying to have you understand what I'm thinking and how I proceeded with this patient. But
I'm going to ask you, Ms. Johnson Gray, did you have any questions for the doctor?
I do not.
Okay, and Ms. Bowman,
I'm going to give a comment. A couple of them. First of all, being somebody in her 70s who plays pickleball and does go to a podiatrist, I do not want surgery. And most of my friends and most of the people that I play with and I'm active with do not want surgery. They want orthotics. They want to be told about shoes that will work because we don't want to be out for 6 to 8 weeks. We want to be able to do what we want to do. However, I will tell you that when I go to a doctor and they see I have a problem and they offer me a cortisone shot, I will not go back to that doctor. I want them to see what is causing the pain. And that's something that it doesn't look like. It looks like you just gave a cortisone shot. And that's dangerous. It's dangerous because cortisone does cause issues. And especially since I believe, as I've been told in the past, it does build up in your system if you have too many. But the point is that that is not a fix. That is a Band-Aid. And if somebody can't tell me what the problem is, I won't go back to them. Now, this patient came to you with pain. They came to you with swelling. And the result was a cortisone injection. That's where I had the problem. And then 11 days later, they were in the hospital with an infection. That is what I see. It wasn't your care beforehand. Now, telling a person, can I go and play golf? My husband's a jock. I love sports. I love to be active. You know, sometimes I don't do that. I just do it. If it feels okay, I'll do it. Even if I rest a little bit, I'll do it. But I do want to be told about alternatives, and I have never met anybody who doesn't want to be told about alternatives. Your comments about your wife, I've been through it, been there, done that, and I was also at Mayo, and follow-up was right there, continuous to this day. So, again, I'm not sure what it is with your wife or Mayo or what happened. But yes, I have the same diagnosis, I have the same issue, double mastectomy. Yes, there was follow-up. But at no time did I ever go to a doctor and they say, well, I'm not sure what's wrong, but hey, the shot's going to make it feel better. Because first of all, it only lasts a couple of weeks at the most, a cortisone shot. So that's my only comment to you. You made comments and assumptions that I believe to be totally invalid about people wanting surgery when they go to the doctor. Especially podiatrists, because everything is on the feet. Can't do anything when you're focused. So just a comment to think about.
Right, but sometimes the primary care has treated the patient and is sending the patient, same thing, if you're going to the elbow surgeon, maybe you go to the foot surgeon. They're sending them. But I don't disagree with you there. I will just highlight, I appreciate what you're saying very, very, very much, but but just remember the cortisone shot was on 8/19. Mm-hmm. I saw the patient on 8/26 and discussed with him. That's why we ordered the MRI, because you were saying, I want to know as a public person, as a patient, what is wrong. That's exactly why we ordered an additional test to better make that determination.
So the cortisone shot came first, and then the MRI.
The cortisone shot came on the 19th of August.
First.
The patient had the MRI on 8/27.
Right. So the first thing you did was give him a cortisone shot, and then you gave him an MRI instead of the other way around. That was my point.
Well, we IND'd the area, and that was followed by a corticosteroid injection on the 19th of August. Then we saw him again on the 26th.
Understood.
Just for clarification, we saw him on the 26th. We ordered an MRI, and had the MRI on the 27th.
Cortisone shot was already given.
Yes,
okay,
on the 19th.
That's my point.
Correct.
I'm going to just double check one more time with Dr. Foreman or Ms. Justin Gray if anybody has any other questions for the doctor.
I don't.
Okay, so.
I do not.
Thank you so much. That the board, okay, we obviously have to determine if this is, you know, an unfortunate outcome or if this is a complication to the procedure or is this a deviation from standard of care. So, again, discuss this if anyone has any thing they'd like to offer. I don't know that, I don't think anything is egregious here. There's nothing set out to be, for the doctor to cause harm to, he didn't set out to cause harm to the patient. So as I see it, of course the options are dismissal, an option for a letter of concern, or if you feel that there is an option of a non-disciplinary CME. So I'd like comments and remarks on that. Because I think you know my feeling. Myself, personally, I would have done an x-ray on that visit of 8/19. I would have sent personally, I would send the fluid for evaluation because that time frame between the initial surgery and that. So that's, to me, that would direct me to a letter of concern. Again, we have the discussion of the steroid being injected into an area where there was a possibility of infection, which we know is not the option that you should do. That's going to spread an infection. But that the patient could have come back for a steroid injection. So that is my opinion. Dr. Foreman?
Is that a motion?
No, I just want to ask your opinion. Is that how you would have...
I would have said an x-ray. I agree with what you said.
And just for the record, Dr. Campbell, this is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. You had just said that you would have done that.
That's my opinion.
But you're not saying that it fell below the standard of care. You're
right.
Saying it could end up in a CME or a letter of concern, but
right.
It doesn't rise to the level of discipline.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. Because, what I would have done, what's the standard of care in community? And remember, we always say it's the minimum. So what I would have done may be totally different than somebody else would have done. Completely ignoring the situation, that would be a breach in the standard of care. But the situation wasn't ignored. So that's why I'm saying, that's why I discussed those two options. Is this a letter of concern? Is this non-disciplinary CME? So that's why I'm asking for discussion from my fellow board members as to where they think this falls in our guidelines for care. or to how would you case the complaint? So if my members or public members have a comment they'd like to make, or if they are leaning one way or the other to speak.
I'd like to say something.
I know you're not surprised. No, I appreciate it. That's what we're supposed to have robust conversations.
The incision and drainage was performed on August 19th. If there was a drainage need, then why would you give a cortisone shot? That's my question. If there's drainage that tells me there was swelling, there was something, I think that is where I have the concern, is that cortisone shot. You're talking about the fact they came to you, they needed an incision and drainage under local anesthetic in your office, and yet you would give them a cortisone shot if you needed drainage. I don't understand why, because if they need drainage, then there's something going on, which could be an infection, and even though it may not look... Pardon?
I was just saying these aren't questions.
She's just
it's
making comments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even
May
though
I answer?
No.
No.
Even though you said it was clear or whatever, to send that out to be sure, rather than do a cortisone shot that could result in complications, which...
Campbell.
Nope, this is discussion between the board, so again, directed to each other.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I guess that's my question. I agree with what Dr. Challis said.
So do you feel that this is at a level of the offer of letter of concern, that we're concerned that you did not have wait for analysis of the fluid before you injected the steroid, or do you think it's at the level of, okay, we're going to offer a non-disciplinary CME? That's kind of where I think we are here, is we have to decide what level of involvement here with saying, okay, we don't like we're concerned about what you did, and just keep this in mind for the future, or do we say, okay, you need some education about this stuff?
So, because it is the minimum level of care,
mm-hmm.
it would be in my opinion, it would be a letter of concern, but I have real concern about this minimal level of care. So, I've had this discussion before. So, I would recommend that we do a letter of concern for the process and procedure when somebody comes in with when somebody comes in with an issue that involves swelling and you have drained it, that you check to see, even if it looks to you like it's good, you check it before you give a cortisone shot or anything that could exasperate an infection.
So that letter of concern could be failure to adequately assess and diagnose the issue regarding the drainage and the use of the cortisone shot. Is that appropriate?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So does everybody understand the motion? Okay, to issue a letter of concern. Okay. So do we have a second on Ms. Broman's motion?
I second.
Thank you.
Johnson Gray.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson Gray. It's been moved and seconded to issue a letter of concern to Dr. Coppola regarding failure to appropriately assess and treat after a drainage, an IND.
Yes.
Okay. So, any other discussion? It's been moved and seconded to issue that letter of concern. So, do we have any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The letter of concern will be issued. Thank you so much. All right.
You'll get a letter of concern from
me. Can I make a comment or nothing?
It's over now. Right.
No, so. But can I just, from doctor to doctor?
Oh, you can talk to them after the meeting. I mean, I think we got to keep moving on here.
Okay, so.
Why don't we send out every time for handling on this?
Alrighty. Our next is the issuance of licenses, 5D. We have Tommy Kennedy. Does anyone, this is an application for licensure via comedy. Does anybody have any concerns, questions about this license application? Okay. Hearing none, I'll make a motion to accept the application of Dr. Tommy Kennedy for licensure via comedy. Application complete. And then we would issue that license upon payment of the issuance fee.
Thank you.
And seconded by Dr. Foreman. Moved and seconded and to accept the application of Mr. Kennedy, of Dr. Kennedy. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. The license will be issued. Next is our board elections. It's that time of the year where we need to vote on chair or board president, chair, and board secretary. So, do we have any nominations for board president?
I nominate Dr. Campbell.
Do you accept?
Yes, I'll accept.
I accept.
I'm second.
Go ahead. All right. Vote.
So now we vote. I must recuse. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. And for board secretary, I will make a motion for Dr. Foreman as board secretary.
Do you accept, Dr. Foreman?
Yes.
Moved and seconded. to continue or accept the nomination for Dr. Foreman for board secretary. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. All righty.
Are you going to be getting any more doctors on the board?
Heather can address that in her report. All right. Okay, so we're moving on. Here next is, I'll give a review of the most recent Federation of Podiatrists Medical Board meeting, which was December the 18th, 2024. I attended that meeting. Heather was at a meeting regarding some legislation, so I can just give you a quick overview. They did indicate the new board members for the National Board of Podiatric Medical Examiners and discussed what's happening with the clinical skills examination. Again, this is still being worked out as far as how they're going to redesign that. The testing is occurring at the schools. So again, it's still in that process. Students are signed off on skills, but the clear detail format is not yet available. There was also a presentation by Kelly Alfred. She Master's Education Director at the Federation of State Medical Boards, and she basically described the annual meeting of the Federation of State Medical Boards, which this year is from April 24th to the 26th in Seattle, Washington, just indicating the different topics that are available. And of course, they invite podiatry podiatry boards are invited to send their executive directors to the meeting if they so choose. The next topic of conversation was the podiatric medical licensing compact that is in the process. The Federation of Podiatric Medical Boards is working with Marshall Smith and the guy Rick Masters, who are part of the medical licensing compact in this country. Anyway, more discussion and questions were answered regarding that. One of the questions Heather had me to ask was, did the fingerprint clearance card take the place of a background check? And they said yes, that will suffice for that. Anyway, there was, then we moved on to what's called the community of practice a session where more discussion was had between the member boards regarding compacts, restructuring of boards, fingerprinting, background check, things, what anybody had any upcoming legislation and rulemaking, and I did mention about Representative Contreras' legislation that we discussed last month that was about retention of how long disciplined, non-disciplinary actions are maintained on the board website. And then some of the state medical boards, podiatric boards, are having issues with being able to maintain membership because of financial constraints in their state. So I'm not sure when our next meeting is, but when we do have one, we'll obviously send a report. I would also let you know that Jay LeBeau, who is our member from the Federation and is part of the spearheading of this compact, has reached out to the state associations. They did reach out to Arizona, and they are aware of the compact and now trying to, working with Mr. Abadi, their lobbyist, about at some point in time running legislation. This is still very early in the process. And, you know, Heather may have some other remarks she'd like to make about that. But in a nutshell, that's what's going on there. Does anybody have any questions on that topic?
Madam Chair, board members, if I could just add, I did have several conversations with Mr. Abadi yesterday. He is working with the association members to look further into this compact. He also did state that, you know, before introducing or finding a sponsor to introduce legislation, that they would have open dialogue with the board and make sure that the board is, you know, supportive of that legislation. So the earliest it would be in the 2026 session, possibly even the 2027 session. So I just wanted to kind of add to that. Also, Dr. Campbell had mentioned sending the board's executive director to the annual state medical boards meeting. And I have spoken with Dr. Campbell about that, and I do need to look into the board's funding situation. I do know that there was a freeze on out-of-state travel. I need to look to see if that was lifted. So I'll keep you posted on anything I find out further about that before the April meeting. And that's all I have.
Thank you. All right. Now, our next agenda item is Seamus' overview of adjudication of complaints.
Thank you. Give me one sec, pull it up here. Okay. So, today we're going to talk about adjudicating complaints. It's a good topic, especially good since you just had two, you know, really good discussions in two cases that were pretty complex. So again, this is just going to be about the way you go through the process, the way the process works, your options at each level, things that you should be considering as far as evidence, standard of care. So, the board resolves complaints at public meetings, just like these. It's important to know that the stage of proceeding, it's important to know what stage of the proceeding that you're at. Because based on the stage of the proceeding, the licensee has certain entitlements or due process rights. So, when you're at an initial review, you're going to have the least amount of due process rights. Because in an initial review, the board is not going to have the authority to take a lot of action. You will be able to issue a letter of concern, offer a non-disciplinary order, issue a order for continuing education, or offering a consent agreement for discipline. You cannot take disciplinary action at an initial review. That is why the due process rights are so low at this, or less at this review.
So example of the actions that you can take at each stage. So again, dismiss, issue a non-disciplinary letter of concern. You can remand the matter back to investigation if you feel like you need more information. You've done that before in multiple cases. Investigators review cases according to the board's parameters and make recommendations. The board, as the decision maker, can accept, reject, or modify the recommendations, as you can see. Generally, at this board, we do not ask our investigators to make recommendations. We ask them to analyze the case, analyze the standard of care, find the deviations of the standard of care, and lay it out for the board. The board then decides what what they're going to decide to do. Some other boards ask their investigators to make recommendations. I'm not always a big fan of that, because if the matter were to go to a hearing, one of the first questions that's going to be asked is, you know, as an investigator, were you at all involved in the decision-making process of this case? Well, no, you're not a board member, but you did make a recommendation. So you do have a little skin in the game. So again, I do like the process here that we do not ask them to make recommendations. Again, so your investigative review, ARS Section 32852.01A-C, review the investigative report and provide materials. At that, initial reviews generally should last no more than 45 minutes. Sometimes they have to go over. They're very complex cases. The reason you don't want to go over 45 minutes is that tends to run into the realm of an informal hearing, or even maybe possibly a hearing. But if you believe that you can adjudicate a matter and get it done in a day, and maybe you need an hour and a half on that case, that's totally appropriate. It's just good to aim, you know, especially if there's not a lot going on in the case, to not necessarily belabor points unless you think those points are important and you want to get it across in your final disposition. Again, you can issue a non-disciplinary order for continuing education. Generally, those orders, those hours come in threes. So if you have communication issues, non-disciplinary order for 3 hours of, you know, CMEs in communication, patient communication. If you have record-keeping issues, you know, those generally are going to be 3 to 6 hours. They're going to be a little bit more to give you time to kind of, you know, understand, work with the material, and get why you have, you know, created these issues. One thing that's important to understand with the non-disciplinary order is that once they have finished the CMEs and they have provided them to Heather, that order is satisfied and it's terminated. When you offer a consent agreement with terms, those terms could be continuing education. And you may throw probation in there because you want to be able to monitor this individual for a certain amount of time. With those consent agreements, they're not necessarily going to end once they finish all of their requirements. If you give them a year probation and a year to finish all their requirements and they finish them in 6 months, they could always come back and ask you, hey, you know, would you be willing to terminate this? I've done everything you've asked. And it's similar to what a court would do. And at that point, it's really up to the board. And because you've entered into that agreement with them and they've agreed to be under the agreement for that full year, you don't have to let them off of it. It's up to the board. And then there is I call this the nuclear option, the summary suspension. This rarely happens. Rarely. Summary suspension happens in the case where a practitioner is so dangerous and such a danger to public health, safety, and welfare that the board, it's imperative that the board takes emergency action to remove them from practice as quickly as possible. I'm not going to get into any hypotheticals. Again, you know, I think you can use your imagination, and there's some fact scenarios you can imagine which the board would be required to summarily suspend somebody. And again, we're very lucky. We don't get a lot of sexual harassment, sexual assault cases. We rarely get those. In the event that one of those cases were to be substantiated, that may be a good option for a summary suspension. Again, it's going to depend on the facts. So
when we have those kind of cases, I would always encourage you to ask me to go into executive session, let's discuss, you know, do you think this one's a candidate? But remember, the summary suspension is a nuclear option, because if you decide to summarily suspend somebody, their license is gone that day. The day, as soon as you issue that order, they don't have a license, and we afford them a hearing afterwards. So, due process usually says you can't take a property right away like a license unless you give them a hearing first. But if you're such a danger to public health and safety, and the board articulates that, they can take the license and then provide you a hearing afterwards. The board also has the informal hearing. That's under ARS 32852.01D. And under the informal hearing, the board can dismiss, issue a letter of concern, issue an order for non-disciplinary continuing education, issue a decree of censure, order probation with terms, or move to a formal hearing. We haven't done an informal hearing since Ms. Broman and Ms. Johnson-Grave joined the board. I imagine that there will be a time that we will do that, probably sooner rather than later. And again, the informal hearing is used when you cannot come to an agreement with the respondent, and they've articulated that they don't agree and they're not going to accept a disciplinary consent agreement. So then we're going to go to an informal hearing. And at the informal hearing, then you don't have to ask them to agree to it. You can just issue that disciplinary action. And again, those terms are going to be probation, civil penalties, maybe a chart audit, maybe some kind of monitoring, could be ethics courses, it could be a multitude of things. So then the next would be the formal hearing. So the informal hearing, you still can't figure it out. Well, let me stop there. So if we're at an informal hearing and we issue a non-disciplinary order, or we order a disciplinary probationary order, that's an order. It's not an offer. So if they don't accept it, then we're not going to formal hearing. We're going to a judicial review action. And a judicial review action is basically where they just look at what the board did. They say, okay, we'll look at your facts, we'll look at your evidence, and we'll look at the order that you created in this matter. And we want to make sure it all lines up. If it lines up, you're good to go. If it doesn't, or you didn't really have those facts and you thought you did, then it can go south for you, and you can lose that JRA. The nice thing about a JRA, though, is it's always going to come back to the board. They're always going to remand it back. The Superior Court's not going to do their own. They're not going to do the board's work. So if it does not come out of an informal hearing, then it's a formal hearing. And the board can move matters to formal hearing before they do not have to go to an informal hearing. The board determines in an initial review that you are such a bad actor that they don't even think that there's a reason to talk to you about it. You can say, we're going to formal hearing, and we're going to give Seamus the opportunity to offer you a consent agreement to surrender your license. It's called a voluntary surrender, but it's not really a voluntary surrender. It is discipline. It's reported to the MPDB as discipline. It goes on the board's website, and it is effectually a revocation. So it's exactly the same as a revocation. It's called a voluntary surrender. It's good for individuals who are going to lose their license to save everybody time and money. They get to control, you know, we allow them to massage a little bit of the facts, right? But again, it saves a lot of time and money as opposed to the expense of a formal hearing. A formal hearing could take anywhere from 3 to 6 months to make it to OLA. It's going to, with our cases, it's almost always going to require experts. Those experts can't be the board members. So there's a lot that goes into these formal hearings. And I, since the time I've been with the sport, we have not had to do a formal hearing. People have always been willing to accept whatever the board issued or enter into an agreement with the board.
Have we done those consent agreements, or consent agreements, what do you call the, when we've met with
Yes, we have got informal settlement conferences.
Informal settlement conferences.
Which that's the nice thing. Whenever there's a JRA, there's the opportunity for a settlement conference before the court. Whenever there is a case before the board, there's always the opportunity for an informal settlement conference. You know, you'll always hear me say, if we are going for non-disciplinary action and they want to go to court, we need to really consider whether that non-disciplinary action is what we think we have to have. Right? And maybe it's just a letter of consent. Right? Those are just considerations. And maybe it's not. Maybe it's, you know what, we're going to hearing on the non-disciplinary order because that's the position that the licensee is putting us in. So, again, licensees are entitled to have the board make decisions based solely on the facts presented in the case at hand. So, as we talked, don't do outside research. You know, make sure that you're only looking at what's in front of you. If you have questions, feel free to ask me. You know, I think Dr. Campbell, Dr. Foreman, even our respondents have been very good about, you know, trying to help public members, help me as well, to understand more of the nuanced medical stuff. Because a lot of it tends to go over my head as well. So, again, the facts are derived from information and documents provided by the complainant, the licensee, staff investigator, and possibly a professional consultant or expert. So you also never see me bring anything in from the outside. I'm never going to bring in any laws or anything like that to upset the apple cart. I'm only going to focus on what the board did, on what's in front of the board.
So I just want to be clear. When you're saying no research, but when I see something like neural or something like that, I don't know what it means, then I can look that up.
I think that's appropriate.
Okay.
Yes, so absolutely.
Medical terms I can look up.
Exactly.
I just can't look up Seamus. Yeah.
Exactly, right. If Seamus is the respondent, it would not be appropriate to look up Seamus, look up his Yelp, you know, see if there's anybody else who had issues. At the board meeting, professional members may apply their own experience and training, as we've all seen. The reason you're appointed is the expertise that you should bring to every matter. So again, if you're a member of the profession, you're here because, you know, you have specific insight. If you're a public member, you also play a very important role here because you have a specific insight. And you can see when, you know, if you have almost an imbalance of public and professional members, you see matters go one way or the other. But there tends to be a lot of back and forth discussion here, and you guys seem to meet in the middle a lot. So, you know, you all have a role to play, and it's very important. And sometimes as a practitioner, it's easy to get into that mode where you go, well, you know, I would have done this, but is it that bad? And then a public member goes, oh, my gosh, they did this to that person? And you go, okay, well, I'll think about it. Let me think about that. So, practice.
That's what happened today.
Exactly. Practice trends may change. So that's one thing that we always have to keep up with is the practice trends may change, and so does the standard of care. Standard of care is very fluid, and it changes all the time, especially with technology.
Very minimal.
Yes, very minimal. Again, yes, the minimum standards, as the law schools like to say, it's a threshold, not a gateway, right? You're not asking for permission, you're meeting a threshold. Do not refer to or ask questions about previous board action against the licensee until the board determines that there's a violation. You're not generally going to see that. Our investigators don't have access to that information. But priors are important. If you do determine that someone has done something inappropriate, you can say, okay, in this case, we believe there's a violation, and this is the violation. And then you make that motion. After you found that violation, you can say, Heather, does this individual have any priors? And then we want to know if they have priors related to the allegations that are before the board, right? The fact that the licensee has a history of discipline is relevant only to the penalty and not whether the allegations in the present case are true or not. And that's why, in order to silo it off, you make the decision on this case of whether they've made committed a violation. Then you look at their history. It's no different than in an actual criminal court, right? In a criminal court, they're never going to talk about, you know, hey, you shot somebody during their case in chief. At the end of the hearing, at the end of the trial, when they're deciding whether to send you to jail, then they're going to talk about whether you shot somebody before, right? That's when that information comes in.
And what about board members? What about doctors who are board members that have, or applying for board membership that have priors and the number of priors. Are they, is that determined whether or not they're allowed on the board? Is that a consideration?
As long as you're in good standing. And again, I don't even know if that's true, because the governor appoints people to the board. So it's really the governor's decision who sits on the board and who doesn't. You know, even if you were to not hold the credentials to sit on the board anymore, as a public member, it wouldn't happen. But let's say you didn't hold the credentials anymore. It's really not up to Heather or the board to say, you're not on the board anymore. It's up to Heather to go to the governor's office and say, I feel like one of my individuals doesn't meet the requirements. I'm worried about my decisions now. And the governor will jump in. So as far as how board members are appointed, that is very much done at a very high level. And it's not everybody has a complaint. Not everybody has a substantiated order either. So I always think it's a consideration, something to take into account, something to ask them about, you know. But many of my board members have complaints. Some of them substantiated in a letter of concern or non-disciplinary action, like CMEs. And it's uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable, but it happens on every board. So stay focused on the case. Board members may wish to ask themselves, what are the allegations? What information is needed to decide whether the allegations are true? Do I have that information, or do I need more? What information is credible and persuasive? If the allegations are true, what penalty is appropriate? And I mean, I watched you guys do this in real time in both cases today. You did a very good job. And it's hard. It's difficult sometimes, especially when you're trying to nail down a standard of care. And you don't want to lock yourself into a position either where, you know, the next person that comes up says, well, the board said this was the standard of care. So, while each case is different, facts vary, licensees have a very disciplinary history, strive to issue consistent discipline. And that can be difficult. You forget what you've done in past board meetings, but it's important to remember that certain facts minus aggravating factors should end up in likely the same disposition. You shouldn't have wildly different dispositions for the same set of facts. Need to avoid challenges that decision making is arbitrary, capricious, or abuse of discretion. So, again, if you had two respondents that came in for the exact same issue, exact same facts, everything's equal, and one gets disciplined, the other one gets a letter of concern, the guy who got disciplined is definitely going to argue that we were arbitrary and capricious. So, motions, making motions. So, there are six general steps in completing the motion. You make the motion, second the motion, repeat the motion, discuss the motion, sometimes you discuss the motion before as well, and then you vote and announce the result of the vote. If it is, I won't get to that. Discussion may precede a motion. The chair asks, do I have a motion or is there a motion? Only one motion at a time. Best practice is that the chair does not make motions or second them. As you can see, Dr. Campbell often does not make motions. I don't know why. That's just part of Robert's rules. A lot of this comes from Robert's rules, but I think a lot of it is because the chair is directing the meeting and doing a lot of the stuff. They feel it's more appropriate for the other members to be involved by making the motions. After being recognized by the chair, make a motion by saying, I move that, or I make a motion that. I move that the board grant Lily Amir's application for licensure. Do not say, I motion that. Do not simply say, so moved, although it does happen quite a bit. And that's okay. These are best practices, right? These are things to just keep in mind. Sometimes people will say, well, Davis, you just said it. Is that a sufficient? Well, if you agree with me, then it's because it's on the record now. Following types of statements are not motions. I'm thinking about, I suggest that, I recommend that, or I want to. And the easiest way to not go down a bad road with that is don't second those motions. So when someone says a non-motion, everybody just wait for a motion. Or ask, you know, ask Dr. Foreman, is that a motion? Specific person should be designated to write down each motion as it's made, because it does that for you. Ask the maker to repeat or clarify the motion as incomplete, unclear, or nonsensical.
I did not add nonsensical in there. That was my colleague. Making an adequate motion is the board's responsibility. Do not expect staff to clean up a nonsensical or incomplete motion after the meeting. So that's one important thing. As soon as the meeting's over, if we had a bad motion, a lot of times the only thing, and again, what we do here is really rarely ever fatal. We can always bring matters back. We can always readdress the issues. But with motions, that means we can slow things down big time. If we don't have an adequate motion, then it has to come back to the next board meeting for you to remake that motion. So again, just be clear and understandable in your language. Without a second, the motion dies. Okay, informally, many boards permit discussion. Again, we have been doing that as a practice. And if that helps you guys in order to formulate the disposition and the motion that you want to make, then I would encourage you to continue having that discussion before you make the motion. Stay focused. Avoid drifting to other subjects. If the allegation is that the licensee violated a particular board rule, then discuss the evidence that supports or contradicts the violation. Discussion of whether the rule is a good rule or not is irrelevant. And I've never heard that at the board here, but it does come up where boards just simply don't like the regulation. We have to impose the regulation as it's written. If we don't, we open ourselves up to potential criminal and civil prosecution, including penalties. So again, we have to enforce the rules and statutes as they're written, whether we agree with them or not. If we don't agree with them, then we can always seek a change, and Heather is very adept at that.
I apologize. I am running.
No, that's okay. I'm going a lot longer than normal. So, okay, so let all members wish to speak have a turn first. Board members should not interrupt each other. They should wait for their turn. Interruptions make for an unclear record and cause confusion. Board members should feel free to express respectful disagreement. I think you guys do a very good job at that. If one or more board members habitually dominates the discussion, the chair may wish to vary the order in which members are called on. That's not an issue here. Board members should read the board materials in advance so they are prepared to discuss. It's very obvious if you have not read the materials beforehand, you tend to ask questions that have already been answered or that are right in front of your face. So, just remember to read everything. Every member need not necessarily comment, but there should be discussion before a vote is taken. If imposing a penalty, one or more members should explain why that penalty is more appropriate than another. There's roll call and also voice voting. Roll call is used for discipline. Voice voting is used for non-discipline. Sometimes in a telephonic setting, Robert's rules say, always use roll call. We don't always use roll call here. Maybe something we could think about doing in the future, since we do have members that attend virtually. And then, again, abstention and recusal. So I'll just go through those quickly. So abstain means you just decline to vote. If you have, if you feel like, if you don't have to recuse, but you feel like you should not be hearing this case, then you can abstain. If you missed part of the discussion, you should abstain. If you feel like you can't be unbiased, or you have some kind of conflict, or a conflict that may create an appearance of impropriety, then you should always recuse. And again, if you have questions about that, I'm always around. Email me, call me, talk to me before the meeting. And then recuse. So if you recuse, there's no discussion, no vote, no nothing. Robert's rule says you should push back from the table or go sit in the gallery. I'll leave that up to you as long as it's clearly obvious that you are not participating. And again, recusal is mandatory for statutory conflicts of interest and for bias, prejudice, and prejudgment, which we will have. We will train on those next month, most likely. But just remember, if in doubt, talk to me or recuse. And be prepared, be fair, you cannot help but do good work. There you go. Thanks, guys. I know I went a little longer than usual.
That's okay. I know we have an adjournment, but I have to be there. There's no problem. Okay. We're here. There's nothing else I have to be voted on, so it's fine. Good to see everybody.
Good to see you. Have a wonderful day.
Bye. Bye. Go take care of the kids. Come on.
All right. Next is Heather's Executive Director's Report.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, Board Members. Real quick, I have been in contact with the Governor's Office regarding appointments, and they are aware that two physician members have applied, but they have not been appointed yet. And they do know that we are one physician member. We have one vacancy for a physician member. So I just wanted to update you on that. This is the time of year that annual disclosure of conflict forms are required to be completed, or maybe not required, but it's strongly recommended by the Department of Administration. So I have included those in the board member folders that are present, and for those members that are on the phone, I can email those to you for completion. My other item is, you may recall that in December the board reviewed a draft bill that Representative Contreras was intending to sponsor in this 2025 legislative session. I did attend that meeting to, at the direction of the board, to express the board's concerns that the time frame change from 5 years to 25 years is excessive. Representative Contreras and her staffer that was there was very receptive to all of our input. There were several other boards that felt that the time frame was excessive. Other boards, didn't believe that it was an excessive amount of time. She said that she would be working on the language of the bill and that she would send out correspondence to all of the health boards. To date, we haven't received any correspondence. The legislative session begins next Monday, and some early bills have been introduced, and I haven't seen this bill be introduced yet. I'll have a more thorough update, of legislation at the board's February meeting. So I can answer any questions on that. I did provide a current budget information, and one new complaint has been added to the complaint log since I sent board materials. And that's all I have. I can answer any questions.
Anybody have any questions for Heather?
I do not.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman.
No questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, next is our summary of current events. I don't believe that we have any items under that heading, so we'll move on to calls from the public. And currently there is no public to call upon. Does anybody have, for the next item, is there any items that will be future meetings? Now, Heather, when are the people coming about the physician health thing?
February.
Okay.
I have it scheduled for the February meeting.
Okay.
And for those members on the phone, you may recall that it's regarding the physician health program at its Gateway Recovery Institute. A representative, it's actually the medical director there, is going to be attending the board's February meeting, and it's about a 30-minute presentation. We're going to do our best to accommodate a 9:00 time frame for them. So just so you're aware, that is scheduled for February.
And because we have a guest coming, I think it's appropriate that everybody be present live. Okay, and if there's anything else you'd like to see, obviously, on any future meeting agendas, please contact Heather. Of course, we'll keep you up to date on the compact stuff and any other meetings from the Federation that are obviously pertinent to board business. Our next meeting is February 12th, 2025. We are in room
C.
Back to, right? This is B we're in now, so we're back to our old room. Okay. Because the schedule on me.
No, it is. It's, if you need my confirmation, it's in boardroom C. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Okay. So make sure I'm not saying the wrong thing. I don't want to
have.
Scare off. Anyway, okay. So room C. Okay. So at 11:34 a.m., I am moved to adjourn the meeting. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman, and moved and seconded to adjourn the meeting. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
The meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Good work. Keep
going. Great day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Everyone else has left a call.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Questions and the rabbit holes that public members go down.